Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Sudanese are waiting eagerly to see whether Al-Burhan is going to fulfill his promises that he made to the people, that is going to form a sovereign council and as well as a civilian cabinet that is supposed to come and run the institutions of the country.
Life returns to normal in Sudan following the massive anti-military junta protest Saturday.
A fully fledged, fully capacitated, with all the terms of reference being taken and given to the commission by the state so that it can actually have the full might of execution afterwards. So that's what we want to do.
The Human Rights Commission calls on the authorities in Eswatini to investigate the circumstances behind ongoing political unrest in the kingdom.
So I want to make sure that the proceedings in that suit are conducted and thoroughly observed to meet all due standards of adjudication.
And a team of lawyers from the Igbo ethnic group petitions a Nigerian High Court in Abuja seeking to be part of a suit that wants the country's southeast region to succeed. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Sudan, life has reportedly returned to normal following the massive protests in some parts of the country, including the capital Khartoum Sunday. Tens of thousands of protesters went into the streets Saturday to denounce this month's coup. Local media reports at least three people died and 100 were injured when they were shot by state security officers during the protest. Shouting no to military rule, the protesters marched in support of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok's transitional government deposed by the military. This despite the deployment of soldiers and armed security officers in Khartoum. Critics of the coup are calling for continued civil disobedience against the military. Coup leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan defended his action, saying it was necessary to stop a civil war. But the protesters demand that he and his officers step down. The military shut down the internet and telecommunications following the takeover, a situation that protest organizers say is continuing in spite of the backlash and international condemnation. For the latest developments following Saturday's protest, I read journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The aftermath of the protest, it differs from area to area. It differs from place to place. In Khartoum, today is the first day of the week where people are supposed to resume their normal activities. But then in some areas, some few offices have opened, few businesses have opened. Life has returned to normal in some areas, even though there is a still presence of the heavy security deployment around the government institutions and other vital installations. And in some areas, some few government public employees have returned to their work, but the turnout is really very low.
How are Sudanese reacting to the call by protesters Saturday for continued civil disobedience across the country?
Yeah, some of them are actually responding to it positively. Some are not. The call has been made by the protesters and Sudanese professional associations and some political parties who are actually part of the previous government that has been dissolved by the military leader. And due to these circumstances, some employees decided not to go to work as a response to the civil disobedience call. But some who are maybe pro-government or pro-military junta, they decided to, you know, go back to the work, especially for today. So there is a little bit of division among Sudanese whether to support this military government now, or to support the Sudanese Professional Association, or to stand with the political parties. You know,
Michael, overall, what has been the reaction of the military junta following the protest? And have the officers, the military junta, announced a structure of government after taking over?
Up to now, there is no proper structural government in Sudan. It is what we can call a one-man show by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. He has not announced any sovereign council that he's promised. He has not announced the name of the prime minister, who is expected also to announce the government. No judicial system in place. But there are speculations that he's engaged in consultations with different entities, with different political parties and civil societies, that maybe this week we expect he to announce the names of especially the Chief Justice, because currently there is no Chief Justice in place. So Sudanese are waiting eagerly to see whether Al-Burhan is going to fulfill his promises that he made to the people, that is going to form a sovereign council and as well as a civilian cabinet that is supposed to come and run the institutions of the country.
That was journalist Michael Atit. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. In Eswatini, the Human Rights Commission is calling on the authorities to investigate the circumstances behind ongoing political unrest in the kingdom. The call was contained in a report the Rights Commission released Saturday. It showed that during political unrest in June, at least 46 people died, 245 were injured, and 235 were detained. The call followed an investigation the Rights Commission conducted after pro-democracy groups organized a series of protests across the country demanding democratic political reforms. The protesters want to be able to vote to elect their own leaders. Critics say the government is unlikely to implement the recommendations contained in the report. This, despite the fact that the findings sharply contradict official figures and narrative put forth by the government. To learn more about the newly released report, I reached attorney Sabelo Masuku, head of the Human Rights Commission.
We just wanted to get some verification because there were quite a number of different reports from government. Government was basically speaking about 27 deaths. Civil society was speaking about 70 deaths. And then other organizations and international organizations were basically speaking about a dozen, not being specific. So we thought, as a human rights institution, independent, we can basically then make a verification and have a record of what our findings were.
The figures you have about deaths, those detained, those injured during the political unrest in June, reflect the same figures that officials released?
No, it does not. So government spoke about 27, and we thought, we verified and we got that it was 46 deaths. So we discovered that, for example, the police did not visit hospitals for some reason. So there is a discrepancy between the official numbers that were released by government and our own reports.
What is the stance of your organization in the call for political reforms?
Okay, so there is a recommendation that has to deal with, that does deal with the basic rights. These are the rights that deals with the right to assemble, the right to demonstrate and all that. When it comes to the MPs that are detained, as a Human Rights Commission, our mandate then becomes constrained because there is a provision that states that once a matter is now before a court of law, the Human Rights Commission cannot, from that point onwards, investigate or interfere with a matter that is before the court.
So what were the major recommendations from this report?
The first key important one is that the prima facie on the face of it, the way people that were arrested, the way people that were injured, the way people that died. And as such, we recommended that the government of the Kingdom of Eswatini ought to make sure there is an investigation to find the root cause of this civil strife. That's the first one. The second one being that an independent board, it could be the commission, by the way, must actually be put in place to make sure that a deeper investigation, you get the complainants to come and place their cases, and they implicate people who become defendants. You then call the defendants to make their case, and thereafter you analyze the situation. You are then able to apportion blame.
Why is your report not apportioning blame when people are peacefully protesting, calling for political reforms? Why are you not defending the fundamental right of the citizens to ask for what they want?
So, what if you read that report? I'm sure perhaps you have a copy of the report. It does state the methodology of the commission and also states the limitations of this report. So, it must actually be read within the confines of its limits. And one of the limitations that is there is to basically say that the capacity of this commission was not able to actually do a thorough investigation. Time that we have such a situation, and as such, we believe that it must be the duty bearer that takes the responsibility. That is why we want to place this report to Parliament, because it must actually place the duty bearer into a position where a fully fledged, fully capacitated, with all the terms of reference being taken and given to the commission by the state, so that it can actually have the full might of execution afterwards. So that's what we want to do.
Attorney Sabelo Masuku is the head of the Eswatini Human Rights Commission. He spoke with me from the capital in Mbabane. In Nigeria, a team of lawyers from the Igbo ethnic group has petitioned a high court in Abuja seeking to be part of a suit that wants the country's southeast region to succeed. This after a group called Northern Elders filed a petition asking the court to force the president of the Senate and the speaker of the National Assembly to expedite the process of granting the southeast region, mostly inhabited by Igbos, the legal authority to secede before the conclusion of plans to amend the constitution. The Northern Elders say they petitioned the court as part of the effort to stop the violence carried out by members of the indigenous people of Biafra, or IPOB. Members of the group have been accused of attacking unarmed civilians as well as the police in the southeast region. The government has designated IPOB as a terrorist organization. Its leader, Nnamdi Kanu, is currently on trial facing charges including terrorism. IPOB want the southeast region to secede from Nigeria to establish an independent country to be called Biafra. Igbo lawyers led by Chief Chuks Umuoma says it is common knowledge that the Igbo communities have not been treated fairly by successive Nigerian government. He tells me that they want the court to allow them to be part of the defenders of the suit so they know the true intentions of the Northern Elders.
We decided to do that because we are not very certain about the intention of the plaintiffs who are seeking the exit of Southeast from the Federal Republic of Nigeria. We were rather surprised at that move, and we are suspicious of that move, and we are wondering whether if it is not a Greek gift. So we want to make sure that we are involved in the proceedings to make sure that it is a suit brought in good faith and not one brought in bad faith to damage the interest of the Igbos.
But some people are suggesting, Chief Chuks, that if this is the case, it will further undermine the country's peace and stability, as well as the unity that brought Nigeria together. How do you respond to that?
Well, Peter, we want to know why the Northerners want to help the Igbos.
to exit from Nigeria. Want to know why? There may be more in it than meets the eye. We are surprised at that type of lawsuit. So we are there to find out what is happening. Why this level of generosity? We want to find out. We are there to watch what is going on. We may not be opposed to the reliefs being claimed by the plaintiffs in court, but we want whatever will happen in court to happen right under our nose to make sure that the plaintiffs are not up to mischief. As for undermining the existence of Nigeria or not, we are not concerned with that yet. We want to know, why did they go to court? I personally desire Nigeria to be restructured. And I think if Nigeria is restructured, where there is justice and fair play and equity for everyone, I don't think that this desire to pull out of Nigeria will see the light of the day.
After this court petition at the Abuja High Court, what's next?
Well, Peter, it is well known all over the world that the Igbos have been politically disadvantaged and oppressed since the early 60s. And it was that oppression that led to the Civil War. At the end of the Civil War, General Gowon said, "No victor, no vanquished." But that declaration was in the air. It was never implemented. And there's no reason why we should trust those who have marginalized and oppressed us and turned us into second-class citizens in our own country, a country that belongs to all of us. So we want to make sure that the proceedings in that suit are conducted and thoroughly observed to meet all due standards of adjudication.
Chief Chuks Umuoma is the lead attorney for the Igbo Lawyers team. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. A group of Cameroonians are meeting in Toronto, Canada, as part of an effort to help resolve the ongoing conflict in the English parts of the Central African country. The retreat attracted participants from civil society, women's groups, and religious and cultural leaders from Cameroon. Organized by the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations, an international non-partisan NGO, the four-day leadership conference is scheduled to end on Monday. Participants are expected to come up with a consensus platform and strategies to engage English-speaking citizens in an attempt to resolve the five-year-old conflict. Human rights groups say the violence between Anglophone rebels and the military has left over 3,000 people dead and over a million displaced from their homes. To learn more about the retreat, I reach Professor Lilian Lem Atanga, a leading member of the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations, and asked her about the conference.
For the past 5 years or more, there has been this violent conflict in Cameroon, and the leadership itself is fragmented. The government of Cameroon is not coming forward for any negotiation. The international community claims they don't know who to speak with. And it's a stalemate. And the CDN realizes that with this stalemate, nothing is happening and things are only going worse. With that in mind, and following the virtual conference that the CDN held in 2020, of which one of the resolutions was to bring the leadership of the Southern Cameroons to sit together and talk together and chat a way forward, we decided to organize this retreat in Toronto to bring these major frontline leaders and stakeholders coming from civil society organizations, religious bodies, cultural movements, to sit with these frontline leaders and have a common ground, a common front to chart the way forward in the Southern Cameroon.
What is the anticipated outcome or perhaps recommendations that this retreat will have, or you expect to have, which you think could help in bringing about or resolving the Anglophone crisis in Cameroon?
I must note that these principles or these outcomes were co-created prior to this retreat based on a consultation of these individual groups of the Southern Cameroon. And I must note here that we engage different groups, the frontline groups, the armed groups, religious groups, women's groups, youth groups, cultural groups, such that every Southern Cameroonian will co-own the peace process moving forward to keep away the fragmentation that has plagued the conflict for the past several years and have a common understanding and common ground for negotiation, such that the government of Cameroon can have who to negotiate with. The people of Southern Cameroon will have a common negotiating front, and the international community will no longer complain that they are fragmented, there is no one to talk with.
Some people are suggesting that why do you go out to a Western country and come up with a solution that will be implemented in an African country? How do you respond to such critics?
That's a very interesting question, in the sense that the government of Cameroon has destroyed trust that the leadership of the Southern Cameroons has in the sense that they abducted the Naira 10 from Nigeria and brought into Cameroon. With the Grand National Dialogue that was organized, this frontline leadership refused to attend based on the precedence that their security is not guaranteed. Secondly, if it were to be in an African country rather than a non-African country, not just Nigeria has shown that they can give away the leadership of the Southern Cameroons, but Kenya also showed that they cannot protect the leadership of the fragmented Biafran state in Nigeria. So the frontline leaders expressed this insecurity in an African context and in Cameroon in particular. Now, we approached Canada and we had a safe ground where these people can comfortably travel to without fear of abduction. So it came across as a neutral ground. And I must acknowledge that the government of Canada has really been helpful in logistical processes, in visa processes for this to happen.
What's the next step forward after coming up with recommendations as a common platform for all these Southern Cameroonians? What's the next step forward?
They want to chart forward principles of engagement, especially in relation to humanitarian access, a common agenda towards education. We are expecting that they'll also chart frameworks and principles for negotiation, and they'll also chart frameworks and principles for mediation. Now, this is just the beginning of the process, and if they chart these frameworks, they will then engage in the process to sustainably examine the root causes of the conflict and sustainably end the conflict.
Professor Lillian Lem Atenga is a leading member of the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations. She spoke with me from Toronto, Canada. Ahead of this week's climate conference in Scotland, 10 United Nations and international agency heads, including the World Meteorological Organization, are calling on government to turn their carbon neutral commitment into climate action. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Scientists tracking the impact of human activity on the warming of the planet say the scientific case for urgent climate action is unequivocal. They note rising temperatures have led to increased sea levels and more frequent and intense extreme weather events, such as hurricanes, heat waves, and excess rainfall. The UN and international agency heads have issued a united and urgent call to governments to prioritize climate action, particularly when it comes to water. They say accelerated action is urgently needed to address the water-related consequences of climate change. World Meteorological Organization spokeswoman Claire Nolas says the agency chiefs warn climate change is dramatically affecting the water cycle, making droughts and floods more extreme and frequent, and decreasing the natural water storage in ice and snow.
Changing precipitation patterns are already impacting agriculture. Food systems and livelihoods are becoming increasingly vulnerable, as well as ecosystems and biodiversity. Rising sea levels threaten communities, infrastructure, coastal environments and aquifers.
Participants at next week's so-called Make or Break Climate Summit are expected to commit themselves to reducing greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. The aim is to stave off climate change by limiting global warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Nullis says scientists agree on the urgency to translate the commitments into action and to do more to accelerate carbon neutrality.
The concentrations that are up there in the atmosphere now are at record levels. Even if we reach carbon neutrality tomorrow, the inertia in the climate system, and especially in the ocean, means that, you know, heat will carry on increasing, you know, for several decades, even after that.
At the meeting, Nullis says the WMO, the UN Environment Programme, and the UN Development Programme will announce a new coalition fund to improve the collection of essential weather and climate data. She says the facility will close the growing data gaps that impede the ability to forecast extreme weather events and ultimately protect the climate. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music, from our African collection. But first, in the US, an innovative financial technology company called Simba has launched a platform dedicated to helping to empower African immigrants in the United States to have access to affordable financial products. Entrepreneur Simon Tim Torres, who founded Simba, is a West African immigrant originally from Burkina Faso. He says Simba, the financial platform, seeks to provide free banking services, including money transfers abroad and in the US. His remarks come after Simba launched a new card service, which the company says will ease money transfer services for customers. The Simba customers, Mr. Tim Torres adds, will have access to financial products that will empower African migrants to save more as well as send money overseas. The company will also provide financial literacy programs for African immigrants. To learn more about the financial platform and how it can help empower Africans with saving and investment, I reached Simon Tim Torres, founder of Simba.
Simba is an innovative financial platform that is dedicated to the immigrant community living in the U.S., in particular Africans. Simba provides, you know, free banking, no fee banking. It provides also free remittance to the African diaspora that lives in the U.S. Essentially, what we came to realize that the community, we as Africans, do not have a bank that speaks to our financial needs. Hence why we created Simba, to provide financial services to our community. So we're starting now with free banking. There's no need, there's no $15 or $20 fee to be paid while banking with Simba. And also, we're trying to make it super convenient for our friends and family in the diaspora, our African brothers and sisters, to send money back home to our parents, to our brothers and sisters for free.
What are some of the products that Simba will offer to the immigrant community here in the U.S.? Because they have access to U.S. banks, platforms where they send money abroad. What makes Simba unique, and what other products do you specifically offer to the immigrant community here in the U.S.?
The distinction is it's a full-fledged digital bank with no fee. So the $15 or $20 that they would have paid otherwise to another bank will go directly into the pocket as a saving, which equal close to $360 per year. Second, Simba also offer them free remittance. Rather than using a traditional rail and pay, you know, 20% on the fee that they will pay for transfer money and a markup in the FX, Simba also offer free local transfers. So if I'm sending money to my friends and family from Virginia to Maryland, rather than using other traditional services that will charge you 1% or 2% on the fees, a transfer from a Simba to Simba user is also free. Essentially, we're providing a free financial platform to our immigrant community, to our diaspora community, to empower them financially.
Talking about this money transfer, I know it's a big deal for the immigrant community here. I understand since the launch, you targeted 15 countries to begin with. There are 54 or so countries on the continent. What happens to them?
No, we're in fact targeting the whole of the continent, but we wanted to start first with the 15 countries and focus on those countries and perfect the services that we are offering to the African diaspora. But rest assured that in our product pipeline, we are going to add more countries as we go along to ensure that the full 54 countries in Africa are fully covered. In fact, as you know, in Africa today, we are starting the Africa Free Trade Area. So one of the things that we want to enable, it's increase the flow of remittance into Africa, as well as promote, intra-Africa trade. And so Simba will be positioned to essentially enable, funds to be freely transferred into the continent.
If person A wants to bank with Simba or get a Simba card, what are the steps that he or she need to take in order to bank with Simba?
It's quite simple. They need to go to www.hellosimba.com or go on the Apple Store or the Android Store. So we have an Android app, we have an Apple app that they can download easily. And there's a quick sign-up process to enable them to get onto Simba. And once they're on the platform, they will receive a virtual card immediately that they can use. That virtual card can be linked to their Apple Pay, the Samsung Pay, for the bill pay, or anything else that they want to do. And a few days down the line, they'll receive a physical card in the mail. I want to remind that Simba is a full-fledged financial services with a full FDIC license behind it. So any deposit made with Simba is fully backed by the FDIC. And Simba enables essentially anyone to do the day-to-day activities, bill pay, spend, do the activity, the spending activities on the card, and send money, save, whatever they want to do, like they do with the traditional bank, they can do it on Simba with no fees.
Entrepreneur Simon Tem Torres founded Simba. He spoke with me from New York here in the U.S. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In women's football, the qualifying teams for the second qualifying round of the Africa Cup of Nations, Morocco 2022, are now determined. On Wednesday, South Africa, Botswana, Senegal, and Zimbabwe confirmed their places for the final stage. However, the winner of Sudan and Algeria could not be determined. The match was postponed to a later date due to the situation in Sudan. The first leg will be played between February 14th and February 17th, 2022, and the draws are as follows. Uganda will take on Kenya, Burundi will play Djibouti, Zambia plays Namibia, Zimbabwe is against Botswana, South Africa plays the winner between Algeria and Sudan, Tunisia is playing against Equatorial Guinea, Cameroon against Zambia, Togo against Gabon, Senegal will play Mali, Guinea-Bissau will play Burkina Faso, and Nigeria is against Cote d'Ivoire. Meanwhile, the Guinea Football Federation has terminated Didier Six as coach of the national football team, the Sili National. Six will be replaced by Kaba Diawara and Manjoun Diallo, according to the federation's website. The Sili National are unable to reach next year's World Cup in Qatar after taking just 3 points from their 4 matches in Group I of the African qualifying. The Guinea Football Federation said negotiations with Six over an amicable separation were underway. Diallo will be assistant to Diawara, who has no previous experience as a senior head coach. Former France international, 67-year-old Six, has been in charge of Guinea since September 2019 and guided the West Africans to qualification for next year's Africa Cup of Nations. Guinea have been drawn alongside Senegal, Zimbabwe and Malawi in Group B for the tournament in Cameroon, which begins on January 9th, 2022. Meanwhile, a team of 11 former international footballers recently toured the facilities that will be used during January's Africa Cup of Nations and praised the stadia which will be used. Six stadia will be used for the tournament, including two in the capital Yaounde, the refurbished Ahmadou Ahidjo, and a brand new one in the Olembe area of the city, where the opening game and the final will be played. Douala also has a new facility, the Japoma Stadium, and the other venues are the towns of Bafassam, Limbe, and Garoua. In cricket, South Africa had a 4-wicket win in the final over against Sri Lanka in the men's T20 World Cup. Defeat does not eliminate Sri Lanka, but a second defeat in 3 games leaves them very unlikely to progress. Before the game, South African wicketkeeper Quinton de Kock took a knee on his return to the side, having apologized after withdrawing from the win over West Indies for refusing to make the gesture. Earlier, Namibia, the tournament's lowest-ranked side, beat Scotland by 4 wickets in their first group game on Wednesday after making the Super 12s at the first attempt. Namibia was due to face Afghanistan in their next match. Later, they face Pakistan, New Zealand, and India. They beat the Netherlands and Ireland in the qualifying rounds to reach the Super 12 phase. And that's about it for this edition of Net and Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Yesterday, Saturday, thousands of Sudanese civilians gathered to protest the seizure of the government by the military in cities around the country, as well as in and around the Khartoum. They called on the military to restore fully all the conditions of the transitional government. They requested the government to bring about full civilian rule in the Sudan, because November was the designated time when the civilian leadership should have taken the full command of the transitional government. On the other hand, the government, since it seized power last Monday, committed to restore free and fair elections in July 2023. In the meantime, the military said there would be a civilian transitional government, that is, civilian of their own choice. In the meantime, it stated that the governments, departments of governments, will be managed by technocrats. All these statements are rejected by the civilian component of the transitional government. There was bewilderment in the international community that things have turned out like that in the Sudan. The transitional government emergence had brought out the Sudan from a pariah state to a country that was engaged with the international community. The United States had removed the Sudan from the list of countries promoting terrorism. The Bretton Woods institutions were engaging with the Sudan. And it seems that Sudan was being widely embraced. So what happened? Frankly speaking, any meticulous observer of developments in the Sudan, particularly after the recent failed coup, would have predicted that the transitional government was in grave danger. What is required in looking at Sudan is a balanced, impartial, and impersonal analysis of developments in the Sudan. The first thing one has to take into account is that when you have a transitional government, it is necessary to have a short period. 2 years is reasonable. We must recall that prior to the settlement, setting up of the transitional government, there was widespread debate as to what to be the duration. Some proposed a shorter time, others longer time. They settled on the time now agreed to. Second principle, it is vital that when you have a transitional government, you have to have certain principles. The first one is this. Transitional governments are not elected by the people. They are selected. And because of that, one should not expect transitional governments to take decisive decision on highly controversial problems in the country. Their main goal is to ensure that peace is restored in the country, that the economic conditions of the people are tended to, and to prepare them for the end of the transitional period when they, the people, will elect a government of their choice. But what we saw in the Sudan was quite different. Shortly after the setting up of the transitional government, outside forces began to put pressure on that government to promote their own policies and interests. One case was clear to many, compelling the government to sign an agreement like the Abraham Accords. Anyone who has any idea about Sudan in the Arab world could have seen that such a pressure and decision would not be welcomed by all Sudanese. Secondly, international NGOs descended on the Sudan, trying to compel the government to execute the ICC warrant on former President Bashir that he should be sent to The Hague. Again, a highly controversial issue within the Sudan. And thirdly, an attempt to reorientate the foreign policy goals of the Sudan. These pressures on the transitional government must have created divisions that were quite observable to close follower of events in the Sudan. Despite denials from some quarters, yes, there were divisions within the civilians, divisions within the military. We should remember that few weeks before this coup occurred, civilians were demonstrating against those who have been representing them in the transitional government. They were arguing that they were not consulting them, that they were taking decisions without their support, a reminiscence of one expert at once called the Iron Law of Oligarchy. So these fissures and these divisions within the military, within the civilians, and between civilians and military made it possible for the military to exploit this and to claim that the takeover of the government is not a coup, but to prevent a civil war. Now, one must find out what could be done. To follow a cliche of police diplomatic means, this matter could not be resolved by military force. There must be negotiations. There must be creative diplomacy. And this is now what is required. Already there are reports that external forces are trying to be helpful. But again, for the sake of the Sudan and perhaps of Africa, let the people of Sudan themselves be the main concern to work out their own problem. Outside forces could be helpful, but the main people involved must be the Sudanese people. And this can only ensure a stable agreement between the people. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah, yeah. So, everybody come, make you follow me, go. Make you follow me, they feel the rhythm. Say, you know, I'm capable, oh. I am capable in every season. Make you dance and feel the flow. Make you drink and party with me. When the baby don't start to play, say, you know, I'm the melody key.
And anything you need, I got ya. And don't do free.
What you feeling inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see person. I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to move.
Nothing like on down, the intention not to paint the town brown. Silent class, the hobby one she. Anybody gon' come for here, they know the drill. Hey, oh yeah, make it cheap. For real.
So not to tell me, nah, it matter.
And don't do free. Oh yeah, I'm bad.
So baby, scare, baby. Come closer.
Cause I don't bite, cause any question you got, I got the answer.
What you feeling inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, when I see apa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when I see apa, I know they see person.
Hey, hey.
I want you to dance, go.
I'm
to worry. Welcome to my party, party. Get the invitation, station. Money, mommy, daddy, daddy. We are moving to position, position. Spray us all the money. That's it with my honey. Pretty money, way, way. Pretty money, way, way. God of my one and only.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Eager, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, anyone who urinates in a stream should be warned because any of his relatives may drink from the water. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.